Thank you, Tom Seeley. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this one, Tom. You said that this is the result of millions of years of evolution to this superior point. Do the honeybees ever screw up and get it wrong?
Yeah, they can. There's one weakness of their decision-making process, and that is that sometimes the best option gets reported late, and that means late in the process. The dancing might have been going on for several hours and for a ho-hum site or sites, and only late in the process does the good one get discovered and reported. And the problem there is that even though the sites that were initially found and advertised are not the greatest, they've gotten a good lead. They've got a head start, and they can build up to a sufficient level of popularity that even though they're not the best, they've gotten to that point first, and the swarm will make a poor choice. And I've seen that in one case, and it was the first for 2 days they didn't find anything good. And then he finally found something good, one bee came back. She danced her heart out. She was very excited, far more excited than anybody else, but it was too late. Swarm took off, went to the wrong site.
So we have a whole handful of questions here, and let's start with, what did the bees on Appledore Island do before you got there and provided suitable homes?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. I forgot to mention that there are no honeybees living on their own on Appledore. No free living colonies. It's too small there. It's not enough forage. I would bring out colonies of bees to Appledore.
And how does a bee become a scout bee? Mm-hmm. Obviously, each one has a technical skill and might be considered an elite.
Yeah, I wish I knew that. I don't know what determines which bees become scout bees, except that I know they're the oldest bees. Evidently, the tools of the trade of being a scout bee are built into the genetics of the bee, because bees do this. Most bees never ever do it in their lives, and only bees in swarms have to do this. So I'm afraid I have to say that's a mystery. But it's like many parts of the bee's behavior. How their genes encode for them to do the waggle dance? Again, they don't have to learn that. They just know how to do that.
And we have a couple questions here as to what extent is it reasonable to consider a hive a sort of superorganism rather than a collection of individuals? That one observes a frame of bees and one gets the feeling that there's some larger management going on.
Yeah, it really is. In fact, it's probably the most accurate way to think of a colony of honeybees, is that as a superorganism, a kind of organism built out of a society, because just like the cells in our body, they're all working together for the success of the individual. For us, it's a multicellular individual. For the bees, it's a multi-bee individual. It really is a functional unit. It's not a superman. I mean, it's not like an organism super, but it's built out of many organisms.
And as you know, most of our bees in this country are so-called cultivated bees, but there are feral bees that have escaped ever since they were first introduced to this continent from Europe. Is the behavior of feral bees different than the behavior of so-called domestic bees?
Yeah, there really are two, it's a really complicated question, but it's the heart of my research these days, so I'll give you the answer as far as we understand it today. We know that the bees that are living out in the woods, say here in New York and New England, they are different genetically. They've been from the bees that you buy if you're a beekeeper, where you order a queen from California or Hawaii or Georgia. The genetics are different, and the genetics of the bees that are living wild have been undergoing very strong selection ever since ever since they were introduced starting 400 years ago. And they have different behaviors, and they actually have remarkable resistance to the varroa mites. That's a whole other story, but capsule summary of it.
Are there such a thing as a rogue bee who just refuses to go along?
No, I've never seen one. There are some very tired bees, some that just can't make that last flight. They've been working hard, and they take off and crash.
And I'm delighted to find how many of these questions concern the whole process of finding hives. But the question that I expected to find first is, how are the bees doing? They're dying off. Is there anything we can do?
Yeah, it really depends on which group of bees we're referring to. The colonies living in the wild, they're doing as well as they did before any of these introduced parasites and pathogens have existed, because they've adapted to them. If you're keeping managed colonies of bees, the secret of success today is to monitor your mites, do a monthly mite check, and when it gets above 2 mites per 100 bees, you have to treat your colony. You just have to treat them with one of the miticides. It could be thymol, formic acid, and there are some others as well.
And here's someone who obviously wants to continue the research that you've started and wants to know exactly how you tag and ID thousands of bees in a single ball.
Sorry, trade secret. it's brute force. You take bees from a hive, you put them, using various techniques, you make little sandwich bags holding 10 to 20 bees. You put those in the refrigerators to chill them down. Once they're chilled down and thus immobilized, you can put them out on a block of that reusable ice, and that keeps them cool. And then you have to just painstakingly go through and put a dot of paint of 10 different colors on the abdomen. And then I've got little, they're called queen tags. They have come in 500 combinations of color and number. So if you've got 10 times 10 colors on the abdomen and 500 different kinds of tags on the thorax, glued individually on the thorax, you can make 5,000 different bees. I didn't go to that. I went to 4,000. But you might wonder, how long does that take? It depends a lot on how many Cornell undergraduates you can recruit to the task. It would usually take us about 2 days of work. But fortunately, the bees then live for 3 weeks. So you've got, for 2 weeks of work, you've got 3 weeks of bees.
We have a good number of beekeepers in the audience, but there are a few people here who want to know what the lifespan for a honeybee is, and if they're all females, how on earth do they reproduce? And yeah. And just give us a quick tour through honeybee reproduction.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see. What was the first part? How long do worker bees
live? How long do they live? Yes.
Yeah, it depends on the season of the year. When they're working hard in the summer, 3 to 4 weeks would be typical. In the winter, they will live from October to May, so several months. And so if you work hard, you wear out if you're a worker bee. How did the reproduction work? Yeah, these are sexually reproducing organisms, and a colony consists not only of the queen bee, who's a female, of course, she's laying eggs, and the workers, which are her daughters, but the colony also, the queen also lays eggs that are unfertilized, and those turn into males called drones. And so a colony is making drones, and it's also periodically making swarming, and when a colony swarms, it rears new queens. And so there are reproductive females, queens, and there are reproductive males, and they mate, and that's how the sexual reproduction occurs. It's a fascinating process. It occurs in special hookup areas called drone congregation areas. Each a queen and the drones will fly out to these mysterious areas. They're about the size of this area here. We don't know what defines them, but once you find one, you can lie in the grass and you can look up and you can watch. You can watch the mating by the bees up in the air. It's a fascinating sight.
I believe there's now an app in production that will help you locate these masses.
Great.
For those who again want to watch the waggle dance and learn from it, the direction is different than the distances in the number of waggles. The direction, you might explain that they're dancing on a vertical surface, and how do they know whether it's to the east or the west of a line between the hive and the sun?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. What they do is they don't. It was misleading. I referred to northeast, south, or west. That's the reference we use. For the bees, direction is always not relative to north, but it's relative to the current direction of the sun. So when a bee performs a dance where she waggles while walking straight up, that means she's saying to the other bees, the target that I'm advertising, be it a patch of flowers or a potential home site, is in the direction of the sun. If she walks down while waggling, it means the direction of that sight is away from the direction of the sun and all angles in between.
Carl von Frisch, who started this all, once said that the honeybee was a magic well, and that we return to study the honeybee over and over again. We draw more and more knowledge from that magic well, and the level of the information in that well remains the same indefinitely. So I think I want to thank Tom Seeley again for sharing his time and expertise with us today.
You're welcome.
So I've just been cued that there's time for one more question. And can we just summarize, Tom? You believe the wild bees are doing much better than the domestic bees. And what can individuals do, if you took the top five things that they could do to assure that both the domestic and the wild bees prosper?
Well, two things, but it's different for the two groups. If for the domestic bees, the key thing is to manage the mites. If when the mite levels get high, the virus called the formwing virus gets high, and that's what kills the bees. So if you're a beekeeper, you want to help the managed colonies, the key thing is to manage the mites, control the mites. If you want to help the wild colonies, it's to provide flowers that are good sources of nectar and pollen. These might be milkweeds around your place or any of the legumes. Think food. Food for the wild bees and some medications for the managed bees.
Well, thank you once again, Tom, for your time and expertise with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org and stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. The program next Sunday will feature Erica Armstrong Dunbar discussing her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Thank you, Professor Seeley, for a wonderful talk. You will have an opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. In your pews, you will find a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program.